Good morning to everyone. I greet you in the name of Jesus this morning. I count it a privilege to be here and share with you today. As we neared our destination this morning, I discovered that some of my family wasn't sure which church we were going to. So it's nice to see that you've settled into this church and made it your church home. Dad had showed us through this church very soon after you had purchased it, and it's changed its looks a bit since then. So God bless you as you minister here in this community. For a message this morning, I don't feel like I have a very deep message to share, but it's a bit more of an introspective message. And if the minister next Sunday shares a message on New Year's, I hope I don't trample too far over his sermon, because the message I have can apply a bit to looking ahead at the New Year. It can also apply to looking back at where we've come from. I'd like to look at windows of the Bible. And as I studied for this message, I realized that windows is kind of a fascinating subject. We take our windows for granted. We have windows in the sides of our church here. They let in light. If you would be in any nominal Christian church this morning, you would probably see windows of a different style. Every Christmas, usually we go to hear a concert. It's an orchestra that is performed in a very magnificent cathedral. At least it is by our standards. By world standards, it's probably a very small cathedral. But as I sit in that edifice and look at the structure, I can almost enjoy that as much as the music. Not quite. I'm sure my wife would disagree to that. But as you sit in that church, the ceilings go up 50, 60 feet. And clear in the peaks, they've got these ornate stained glass windows. And unless you enjoy stained glass windows, you look at that and you just think, well, that's a lot of pretty colors. But if you look closely at those windows, there's a lot of biblical scenes that are portrayed. And of course, it's an artist's rendition. Nobody knows exactly if that's what it looked like. But that's the way some artist thought he could portray some scene from the Bible. And if you take the time and actually look at them and try to figure them out, there's an amazing depth sometimes portrayed in those windows. And I suppose that the builders of those churches thought that those windows would somehow help people worship. And we know that that's not the case. People have worshiped in dungeons and in prisons, and the worship experience is as grand as any of those cathedrals. So I'd like to look at just four scriptures here in the beginning. And I have a lot of scriptures today, and a lot of them are just verses that I have on my notes, and I won't ask you to turn to most of them. But did people in Bible times have windows? Well, they did. We're not exactly sure when windows and glass became commonplace. Some of the earliest renditions of windows was simply translucent pebbles that people collected and built into a frame, and they would hold that up. That was their window. So it wasn't something they could see through. It was simply something that let light into the house. I think the earliest passage in Scripture that we have that would mention windows or glass is in Job 37, verse 18. And these are the words that Job penned. "Hast thou with him spread out the sky, which is strong, and as a molten looking glass?" So Job obviously knew something about glass and windows. And we think that Job probably is the earliest scripture that's ever recorded. We think possibly Moses penned these words, but Job lived, I think, prior to most of the other recorded scripture. 1 Corinthians 13:12 mentions this, "For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know even as also I am known." James 1 verse 23 has this to say, "For if any be a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like a man beholding his natural face in a glass." So some of these passages, I think, talk about glass more as a mirror, something you look into to see what you look like. But we obviously know that people used glass for their windows. And in Revelation 4 verse 16, verse 6, we have this verse, "And before the throne there was a sea of glass like unto crystal. And in the midst of the throne and round about the throne were four beasts full of eyes before and behind." So early on, we had those crude windows made out of stones. Sometime during the Roman era, glass making became fairly advanced. People learned how to blow glass. They learned how to melt sand. And they would make window panes of some sort of glass. But glass was so valuable that only the rich could afford to have glass. And it was so valuable that whenever they would close up their summer home, they would take the glass out of their windows and store it safely. So when they came back to their summer home, they could put the glass back in their window. I'm not sure if they were afraid it would break or if someone would steal it. I don't know if any of you grew up in a home that had the old windows that had the little wavy spots in it, and you look through the window and the trees looked distorted and they looked like they were waving around. I do. I had a window in my bedroom that had some of those little splotches in it. And that was before people knew how to make perfectly clear glass. And the interesting is now that some of these homes are going back to that simply because they want to produce that look again. They want their houses to be period specific. So they're actually buying windows that have that, what I would call imperfect glass in it, just because they enjoy that look. So probably enough on glass. Let's look at windows in particular. What does a window represent? Well, I think windows represent two things. Windows are there for observation. We have this window so that we can look out and see what's out there. Windows also represent opportunities. And I'd like to look at those both this morning. Some of the things we'll look at are ways we can observe and at the same time see opportunities. So they kind of intertwine. Probably the earliest reference in the Bible we have of a window is when God told Noah to build the ark. And he instructed him to build that ark with a window. Genesis 6, verse 16, and it says, "A window shalt thou make to the ark, and in a cubit shalt thou finish it above, and the door of the ark shalt thou set in the side thereof, with the lower second and third story shalt thou make it." Genesis 8, 6, "And it came to pass at the end of 40 days that Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made." So what did that window represent to Noah? All through the 40 days that the heavens were open and the earth opened up from the depths and there was water, that window was closed. That represented safety. But after the storm was passed, after the flood was over, that window to Noah represented something that he could observe through. He opened that window. I don't know here if it says that God really instructed him to open the window. I'm not sure what prompted Noah to open that window, but we know how he did that. He left that dove out, and the first time, I think it came back, or maybe the first time it came back with an olive leaf in its mouth, and then the second time it didn't come back. I might be mixed up on that a little bit. But anyway, that window represented a way for Noah to observe, and it, as part of that observation, then it opened up an opportunity, that when the water receded, the ark settled onto Mount Ararat, there was an opportunity for Noah and his family to get out of the ark. All the animals left the ark. So there you have an opportunity and observation simultaneously. Another one that's very interesting is Rahab. You remember the story of Rahab, how that the spies came, took refuge in her house because they feared for their lives. And Rahab apparently lived on the wall of the city. Like if this was the city wall and here's the house sitting on the wall. I'm not sure why they built houses there, but for some reason that was commonplace. And anyway, she left those spies out of her house down that wall with that scarlet cord. There again, this window represented an opportunity for the spies to escape. It was also a window, I guess, that Rahab could observe, but it was also an opportunity for Rahab, for her to be saved. And we recently had a Christmas sermon, and the preacher detailed the lineage of Jesus. And if you check that out closely, Rahab is in that lineage. This heathen prostitute, because of that window of opportunity, was able to be in that lineage of the Holy Christ child. A few others, just briefly I'll go over. Another one in Judges. This is after one of the battles with, I think maybe this was the one where Deborah and Barak were judge and co-judge of Israel. Judges 5, verse 28 says this, "The mother of Sisera looked out at a window and cried through the lattice, 'Why is his chariot so long in coming? Why tarry the wheels of his chariot?'" That was whenever Jael had taken the nail and drove through the temple of Sisera, and they won a victory for Israel. Another one that's kind of an interesting little passage is whenever Saul was seeking to kill David. Do you remember that story, how that David's wife, Michal, made this image in the bed? She made it look like David was sleeping, but she left him out through the window. He escaped through a window. So there we have a window of opportunity. In 2 Kings 9, when Jehu was purging Israel, he came into Jezreel. And we remember that story of Jezebel. She looked out at the window, and Jehu said, "Who is on my side?" And Jezebel's servants threw her down. Another one that I think very interesting is in 2 Kings 13, verse 17. And if any of you have to do school devotions, this makes it rather interesting, school devotional for children. So this is the account whenever Elisha was with King Jehoram. I think it was King Jehoram. And Elisha told him, take some arrows in your hand. And he said, strike these arrows to the ground. And you remember the king, he took these arrows and he struck them once, twice, three times. And he probably struck with some vehemence too. But Elisha said, why did you stop? You should have struck six or seven times or something like that. He says, then you would have defeated the Syrians until you had consumed them. Now you only have three victories. And then he says, open the window eastward. And he opened it, and Elisha said, shoot. And he shot. So he shot that arrow out the window. And he said, the arrow of the Lord's deliverance, and the arrow of deliverance from Syria. For now shalt thou smite the Syrians in Aphek till thou have consumed them. So there we have a window of opportunity. One more. This is from the New Testament. This was the young man Eutychus. Remember how he sat in a windowsill and fell asleep? It was a long sermon. Paul preached and preached and preached, and poor Eutychus fell asleep, fell out of the window. I've often thought sometimes in my tree stand, maybe I'll fall asleep and fall out, but I guess that's why you wear a harness. Anyway, remember how they rushed down and they thought he was dead. And Paul goes down and says, no, he's sleeping, he'll be fine. And until the sermon was over, till the next day, Eutychus was fine. One other thing here in the introduction, windows have been used in Scripture to represent God's provisions for his people. We've already mentioned the one in Genesis where Noah opened that window, and we know how that the water had dried up. That was an opportunity. That was God's provision. God made the water recede. Another one is in 2 Kings 7, where Israel was at the end of a long famine. They had been besieged for many days, and food was at a premium in the city. They were basically starving. And Elisha, I think, had prophesied that tomorrow food will be so cheap that you won't believe it. It'll be that cheap. And one of the king's right-hand men said, how can this thing be? If God would make windows in heaven, could this happen? And we know that that's exactly what happened. Those four lepers went out of the city and found the army all fled and all the provisions were there. And all these provisions were available to them for nothing, for the taking. Malachi 3:10 has another very interesting message or reference to windows. This is still in the Old Testament setting of tithing, and Malachi says this, bring ye all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be meat in mine house, and prove me now herewith, saith the Lord of hosts, if I will not open you the windows of heaven. So heaven has windows, and pour you out a blessing, so that there shall not be room enough to receive it. And I wonder how many times we shortchange God and we don't think that he can do what he said he can do. God's provisions are endless. And do we have the faith to accept what he says at face value, that he has these provisions just readily available for us? Pour them out. And another one in Daniel. I like this one. It says, now when Daniel knew, this is in Daniel 6, verse 10. Now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went into his house, and his windows being open in his chamber toward Jerusalem, he kneeled upon his knees three times a day and prayed, and gave thanks before his God as he did aforetime. Now I don't know if Daniel saw this window as a window of opportunity or a window of test. And actually it was both. It was a test. It was a test of Daniel's faith, and we know that Daniel aced that test. He went and did the same as he'd always done. He prayed. It didn't matter what the king's decree said. It didn't matter how many of these counselors were against him. He wasn't going to back down. He wasn't going to change his habit. So as he faced that window and prayed toward Jerusalem, it was probably a test. And it was also an opportunity because you know the story. You know how that Daniel survived that night in the lion's den, because God was there. God shut those lions' mouths. And you know the joy that the king had the next morning when he asked, Daniel, are you okay? And Daniel said, I am, my lord, the king. God shut the lions' mouths, and they have not hurt me. And then Darius goes on and proclaims that the God of Israel is the God to be feared. So this was an opportunity for Daniel to show his God to the whole nation, the whole Persian nation. So we've established now that windows represent observation, and they also represent opportunities. So if you need a title for a message, I would say that this morning's message has the title of Windows 2020. And that's not a new operating system for some computer either. And I have a feeling that one of the most misused and cliches that we'll get so tired of is this thing of, may your vision in 2020 be 2020. I've already seen that a couple times, and I got a card from a real estate agent, and he had something to that effect in there. And I have a feeling if we won't be sick and tired of that little cliche till it's worn out. But anyway, for a title this morning, Windows 2020. I would like to take and portray an imaginary window that I'd like you to look through with me this morning. Three different things. I'd like to look at the world scene, I'd like to look at the church scene, and the family scene. And as you look through your own, as we look through a window together, I'm sure that you will see that through the own filter of what your life is. There's things that come into each of our lives that determine how we see things and how we view things. So as I look at, we probably all see the world scene somewhat the same because we see the same articles, read the same news, so we have somewhat the same idea of what the world looks like. Your church is specific to your church. My church is specific to my church. And I'm sure we share common goals. I'm sure we see common needs and common opportunities. So that will probably be the same. And I'm sure in our families, you face the same things in your family that I do. But some of those things will be tempered to your specific opportunities and the specific things that you see at the moment. So I feel like I have a lot to cover this morning. I'll maybe be brief. I won't spend a lot of time on each point, but hopefully you can follow through with this as we look at these things through this imaginary window that we're looking through. So we look through the window at the world. We see a number of different things. The one thing we see right now is war. And should that surprise us? I was thinking that probably the continental United States of America has not had a war on its soil since probably the Civil War. If you're a historian or a school teacher, you may correct me on that, but I kind of think that was the last war we have seen in our country. But all you need to do is go on Wikipedia and look up current wars, and it's astounding. Today we read a news article of a shooting somewhere, and if there's 10 people killed, it makes national news, and we think that's a tragedy. But wars on the scale of the world easily number 1,000, and then you see numbers of 30,000 and numbers of 400,000. I think the war in the Syrian war, which happened just in our lifetime, some 400,000 people have been killed. We have no sense of what that looks like. We've been so sheltered. And yet, that's what's happening. Sometimes our window is so small, we see what we see, and we don't realize that the world overall is experiencing something far different. Should this surprise us? No. Matthew 13 says, Jesus answered the disciples, they talked about him, about these magnificent buildings that they saw, and Jesus said that some things will happen before, by the time that the temple is overthrown. And he says this, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. And when ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars, be ye not troubled, for such things must needs be, but the end is not yet. Nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. So as I look on the world scene, we see war, we see trouble. And probably mostly that is something that we observe. There is also an opportunity there. And while this may not affect a lot of us, there are people who are ministering to the massive outpouring of refugees from these torn countries. You know, personally, someone has been in Greece to help with that refugee flood. And I don't think you'll return from serving there the same person that you went. As you see those people facing poverty, facing severe circumstances, I don't think you ever view the privileges that you have the same. And that somewhat ties into another point I have, which is poverty. And a lot of these people that are coming out of these countries as refugees lived very affluent lives in their countries. They were engineers. They were doctors. They had a life like we did. They had children. They went to school. They had the luxuries that we have. And suddenly they've left all of that. They fled all of that because their lives were worth more than their possessions. And now they're facing poverty. They're facing war. And what can we do? We can observe, but as God gives us opportunities, may we use this as an opportunity. May we see this as a way that we can help those who have needs than that are less fortunate than we are. Another thing that we see as we look out this window at the world is persecution. When I prepared this sermon, I went on the website that Voice of the Martyrs has They had a map there that showed, it was a prayer map of world persecution. And on this map of the world, they had dots where the churches was being persecuted and where they had it documented. In the Western Hemisphere, there were dots in Southern Mexico and Cuba and Colombia. Three different countries had a dot where there was persecution intense enough to be registered. In the Eastern Hemisphere, there were between 50 and 60 dots representing restricted or hostile countries to Christianity. And there again, as you look out that window, do you understand the blessing that you have? Somehow we read the martyr's mirror and we think that, okay, that was whenever the church was persecuted. And true it was. But today is the age of martyrs. In a recent article, Justin D. Long emphasized the startling fact that more people have died for their faith in the 20th century than in all the previous centuries combined. Let that sink in for a little bit. During this century, we have documented cases in excess of 26 million martyrs. From AD 33 to 1900, we have documented 14 million martyrs. So as we look out that window, there again, we're looking through this filter of what we enjoy in the United States of America. But that is not what Christians of the world are experiencing. Mark 13:9 has these words, "But take heed to yourselves, for they shall deliver you up to councils, and in the synagogues ye shall be beaten, and ye shall be brought before rulers and kings for my sake, for a testimony against them. And the gospel must first be published among all nations. But when they shall lead you and deliver you up, take no thought beforehand what ye shall speak. Neither do ye premeditate, for whatsoever shall be given you in that hour, that speak ye, for it is not ye that speak, but the Holy Ghost." So to put that in perspective, I'm not sure that we understand the blessings that we have. And I fear that easy Christianity has affected us probably more than what we're willing to accept, more than we're willing to admit. 1 Corinthians 3:11 says, "For other foundation can no man lay than that is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now if any man build upon this foundation, gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, stubble, every man's work shall be manifest, for the day shall declare it, because it shall be revealed by fire. And the fire shall try every man's work of what sort it is." There are a lot of people that are facing that fire today, and I think they're coming out as gold. Sometimes I wonder how well we would fare. And we know that anybody's work that is wood, hay, or stubble would be burned up. But I trust that we're building on the stone, the rock Christ Jesus, and I trust that we're building gold, silver, precious stones. Today, so much attention is given to appearance. Things are built around a shell. Industries are based on making the outside look good, making a facade, making the outside of a person's face or body be attractive. But how much of that would stand the test of fire, the test of persecution? I already mentioned poverty. I don't think I'll spend much more time on that. Simply the fact that we are so blessed. We can go into a supermarket and buy food, exotic foods, foods from all over the world, while other people struggle to put bread on their table. They struggle to provide the very basic necessities of life. Here again, that's observation. We can see that, but it's also an opportunity. There are organizations that we can give to, even if we can't contribute physically. And as our brother mentioned this morning, I think sometimes we hide behind that, what did he call it, the crutch of not enabling people's habits. I think we hide behind that too much. And I think there's more that we could be doing in our local communities to help those who are truly suffering from poverty. The other thing we see as we look out this window at the world is the confused state of the politics of our country and other countries as well, but our country in general, in specific. And the Bible speaks to that. I had to think of the account of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar walked in his house and he said, "Isn't this great Babylon what I have built by the might of my power for the strength of my glory?" Something to that effect. And I would like to answer him with the words of Job. Job answered God, well, actually it was God's words to Job. He said, "Who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge?" And as you read the news, as you hear of all the political goings on, you have to wonder how much of that is words without knowledge. Daniel was a man who sought God's wisdom. Daniel was the advisor to King Nebuchadnezzar. And as he stood before Nebuchadnezzar, this man that they had this elevated opinion of himself, Daniel sought God for the wisdom to answer the king's dream, to actually tell the king his dream and then interpret it. And it says here in Daniel 2:19, the secret was revealed unto Daniel in a night vision. And Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. And he, God, changes the times and the seasons. He removeth kings and setteth up kings. He giveth wisdom unto the wise and knowledge to them that know understanding. He revealeth the deep and secret things. He knoweth what is in the darkness, and the light dwelleth with him. So I guess my challenge to you is, as we look out this window and we see the politics of our nation and the confusion that is there, remember that our kingdom is not of this world. Our kingdom is a different kingdom. And if we can somehow separate those two kingdoms and realize that all this that's happening in our nation and in the other nations is simply God's design to bring forth his eternal kingdom, it does so much for helping us keep our thoughts, keep our priorities right. And I know some people could care less about politics, and some people live and breathe it. So I'm not sure where you are on that spectrum, but remember, this world will pass away and all the kingdoms with it. God's kingdom will stand. All right, let's move on to the church view. We have this window that we look through, and we see our churches. And occasionally I have opportunity to worship in a church that's a non-denominational church or a non-Mennonite church. And one of the things that always amazes me in those churches is the amount of older folks that are there and the scarcity of children. And if we go with our family, our children probably bring the Sunday school attendance to double, just because there are like no children in there. And as we look at our churches and we see all these children, that's wonderful. And I'm glad that we have children. I'm glad that our churches are growing. Can we handle that growth? Will we be able to mentor these children? Will we be able to help them understand that the church life we have is worth living for? It's worth investing in. Are we able to help them? The early church experienced rapid growth. After Peter's powerful sermon, I think it says that 3,000, it says, they that gladly received his word were baptized, and the same day there were added unto them 3,000 souls. What did the church do with this growth? We understand they were living in changing times. We understand those people came because John the Baptist and Jesus had prepared their hearts for this transition to the church age. And I think as Peter preached that sermon, all the dots suddenly started lining up. And I think this is largely a Jewish audience that he preached to. So these Jews knew. They knew these prophecies. And I think all this preparation had finally made them come to the point that as soon as they understood that Jesus was the fulfillment of this prophesied Messiah, they were ready to wholeheartedly embrace this religion, this Christianity. And then we know later that Paul took that message to the Gentiles. And as Gentile believers, we benefit from that. So as you look at the church scene, can you keep your children and your youth engaged and involved in our churches? Can we keep them safe? And sometimes I'm appalled at how easy it is for some of our young people to walk away. And I look and I wonder, could we have done more? These youth have went through our schools. They've went grown up in Christian homes. But for some reason, they decide that the pleasures of the world are easier and more desirable than the discipline of being part of a Christian church. And if you have children here that have walked away, I'm not saying this to condemn you, because each child makes their own decision. As parents, we sow the seed, we provide the environment, but each child must make their own decision about whether their parents' values are worth embracing. Psalm 127:3 says, lo, children are an heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. Proverbs 17:6, children's children are the crown of old men, and the glory of children are their fathers. Proverbs 20, verse 7, the just man walketh in his integrity. His children are blessed after him. So as parents, maybe I'll talk to the parents more when we talk about the family view, but as church leaders, and by extension, all of us that are of our adults, what are we doing to keep our churches safe? What are we doing? Are we exemplifying Jesus to them? Or are they seeing things in our lives that make them question how integral and how personal our walk is with the Lord? Some churches, as you look at them, they're blessed with a lot of older folks. It looks like your congregation, most of you are middle-aged and younger. When we first went to Mount Olive, there was a lot of old people, very few middle-aged people, and a lot of young families. And as churches grow and mature, those dynamics change. But are we able to keep our elderly folks involved? Are we able to keep them feeling like they're useful in church? And I'm blessed with older folks that are willing to get involved and do things. We're working at building a school right now, and there's some older gentlemen, some older brothers in our church that physically don't want to do a lot of heavy labor anymore. But they'll show up just to do the cleanup work. They'll show up just to be there for whatever odds and ends need done. There's a tool that needs bought to help someone's job get better. They're there to run for that tool, that drill bit, whatever it may be. So I guess if I'm going to speak to the elderly folks in our church, be involved. Stay active. This morning we passed, three or four motorhomes headed south. I guess the holidays are over and they're going to the sunny south. And if you spend a few weeks in Florida, I'm not here to criticize you for that. But be involved. Be active wherever you are. The church needs older people as well. Fourthly, as we look through this window of our churches and we see the world around us, the communities that we live in, what are we doing to reach those people? And I know this changes. Different churches approach outreach differently. But sometimes I feel that in the past, as Mennonites, we tend to isolate ourselves as churches and as a culture. And probably then, 40, 50 years ago, probably there were reasons for that. Christian parents saw the need for godly education, so they started Christian schools because they saw the course that the public education system was taking. And that was a good movement. And as we did that, I think we also tended to isolate ourselves a little bit from society. And I don't have the answers as to what we need to do to become salt and light in our communities, except be involved with people. Some of you meet people in the world on a day-to-day basis. I do that myself, depending on what jobs I'm doing throughout the week. And so many times we just go about the job we're there to do and we leave. But are we finding ways to interact? Are we finding ways to witness? Are we finding ways to invite these people to our churches? Do your neighbors know where you go to church? Are we sociable? Do we connect with them as much as possible? Do we share with them when there's a calamity? Do you know if one of your neighbor's spouses dies? Are you there to lend a listening ear, share your condolences, take a meal? And lastly, as we look through the windows of this window at our church life, sometimes I'm a little bit concerned with the amount of busyness that we take upon ourselves. And it seems that some of that is unavoidable. Those of you that are on committees, those of you that are in ministry know that there's an endless amount of meetings that you can commit to. And do we know when we've reached the limit? Do we know when we've reached the point that our families are suffering? Do we know when we've reached the point that our churches suffer because we've committed to too much? And I don't know where that is. There's no easy answer for that because there's so many good things to be involved in, so many things that need our attention. Duties call from all angles and pressures mount. But can we tell when someone is struggling? Can we tell when they're almost to that breaking point where they're not able to handle all that they've been asked to do? Are we close enough? Are we in tune with each other to know when someone is reaching that point? So maybe that window I looked through portrayed what I see from my church. Hopefully there were some things that you could relate to there. I'm sure our churches are a lot alike. We face the same things. We live in the same world. So as we face those pressures, let's keep aware of what's happening and try to see and observe, but also seize the opportunities. All right, lastly, as you look through this window of opportunity, this window of observation at your family, what do you see? Well, that again depends where in life you are. If you're a grandparent, you see your children building their homes and raising their families. You see small children being born into your family. If you're middle-aged, which I have to admit, that's where I am now, I see my children from ages 5 to almost 19. So you have children with various needs all throughout that spectrum. You have toddlers, you have little children that hang on your every word. They think that you're almost God. They bring their questions to you. They bring their problems, and they expect you to have all the answers. you have your young people that are experiencing life and are starting to explore things outside of this realm that you've kept them in all these years. And they come with questions. Do we have the answers to those questions? On the other side, another thing we see as we look through that window is we have the relationship with our spouse. Are we taking the time to make sure that that relationship is met? It's so easy for our lives to revolve around each sphere that we operate in. And we kind of get tunnel vision. You know, we see what we need to do and we forget about the things that our wife is going through. And maybe the other side, maybe the wife sees all the frustrations of raising the children and they forget about the frustrations that possibly we as husbands and fathers are facing. Are we keeping those emotional and physical needs met? I think we do a good job of taking care of the material needs of our family. We're diligent, we're entrepreneurs, we work hard, we try to earn money. And by and large, I feel that probably all our children are well clothed and well fed. But are we taking the same amount of interest in their spiritual well-being? Are we keeping those needs met as well? And as your children are in those different stages of life, are we careful to make sure that the individual needs of each child are met? Sometimes you can tend to view your family as a unit, and you forget that you have individual children that have specific needs. Are we able to be close enough to each of our children so that we know what they're going through? At the end of a school day, ask them how their day went. Sometimes it's always invariably that it went bad, but you know that's just what they say. It didn't go bad. Maybe there was one thing that was bad, but it wasn't all bad. Are we there to hear their frustrations, hear their joys, rejoice with them over achievements that they've made? If they've made a good grade, rejoice with them because they got a good grade. If they got a bad grade, help them figure out why and maybe do some studying with them. Be there for your children. And as we look at our families and that have children that are gone, that are grandparents, that don't have the responsibilities of raising a family anymore, there's needs there that you can fill that don't require as much physical effort. I've heard stories of elderly widows that felt they couldn't be useful in the church. They felt that like there wasn't much they could do. But yet, they spent hours in prayer. And we have no idea on the eternal perspective how much that's done. That's probably done more than all the fighting and frustration that maybe we feel that we're doing when we're struggling to make these things happen on our own. There's people that need encouragement. There's people that just need a card sent to them. There's young people that need mentors. There's young people that are struggling. They just need someone to walk alongside them. There's people that are wealthy, and there's a lot of material needs in the church. There's people that have the gift of being able to give without expecting anything. There's people that have the ability to finance the arms of the church, mission work, whatever that may be. So wherever God has called you to, find your role and fulfill it to the best of your ability, to what God calls you to do. So wherever you're at in your family life, as you look at your family, I trust that you'll be able to understand where God has you, where He has placed you, and what the responsibilities are for you at the moment. And be aware that that changes from young parents starting a home to middle-aged parents trying to raise stable, well-adjusted children to grandparents who are trying to mentor and provide an example to those that are coming behind. There's work there for everyone to do. Ephesians 6:1 reads this way, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with thee, and thou mayest live long on the earth. And ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord." Proverbs 17:6, "Children's children are the crown of old men, and the glory of children are their fathers." Proverbs 20:29, "The glory of young men is their strength, and the beauty of old men is the gray head." So, there you have it, Windows 2020. As you look out these windows and see these things, do you see opportunities? Do you see tests? I'm sure you probably see both. So, you know how hard we work to keep our windows clean. Whenever you were a youngster, probably the biggest thing you did was put fingerprints on the windows. Now that you're older, now you like to keep the windows clean. So let's keep the windows of our lives clean so that we can observe what's happening in the world around us. Let's keep our windows clean so that we can see what's happening in our churches. Let's keep our windows clean so that we can see what's happening in our families. I read an article about how we may live in 2050. Probably most of you here that are my age or younger probably thought you'd never see 2020. But God is still here. God has brought us to the verge of another year. Maybe we won't see 2020. Maybe he will come before that. But if we do, the God that was God in 2000 is also the God in 2020. He will be the God in 2050 if time stands that long. We may be here or we may be in eternity, but God will still be God. So may God bless you as you view these windows of observation and as you view these windows of opportunity. And may God give you the grace to seize the opportunities and fulfill them to the best that he gives you the ability to do. Let's kneel for prayer.